Welcome, everyone. the talk tonight is called Impersonating the Heart. Impersonating the Heart. And I think the language of the heart and the language of the mind need to be very discriminated so that we really understand where we're acting from energetically, what the organ of choice is that we are moving with, and to get the language of it down. And I don't just mean the verbal language, but I mean how it operates, just the feeling of it having, the mind having confiscated or a particular heart quality, and how we'll know the difference between that in its pure form and that when the mind begins to edge it out a little bit off stage. So impersonating the heart is something that I think we really need to be very refined in our discriminating wisdom concerning. And as I was mentioning, we're close to Valentine's Day, and it seems like a holiday somehow for the heart, although it's mostly a holiday for sales of candy, and like most things, it's been corrupted. But if we just dust away some of the ways that the commercialization, it's somehow pointing in the direction of a quality of being that we don't necessarily trust. In fact, most of us feel it kind of sloppy. The heart, our business adventures, and our way of life is much more governed by the logic and precision of the mind, the science of the undertaking we're going to be doing, the programmed blueprint of how we're going to get there, and the plotting our way through the pitfalls that are there along the way. And so most of us find Valentine's Day a kind of inauthentic holiday in which we can turn to those people who we've been with and express the affection of having been with them, and then we can get on with our business, right? So it's a day of being a little sloppy with ourselves. But and so it's interesting to me how poorly the heart is understood in this culture. I think we would all agree with that. And how we compartmentalize the two organs to such an extreme that they barely communicate with one another. So I think, first of all, we need to define what we mean by each, and then we need to look at how one really becomes the throned monarch. We give our attention, our strategies, our life over to one at the expense of the other. And the heart is the denigrated organ. Except, interesting, on those rare nights when we get to go to the opera or to a museum or maybe just to taking a walk in the woods or perhaps even a hiking the forests, then something switches, doesn't it? And we find the attunement of the heart through beauty, through the arts, and that somehow this organ steps forward in a predominant role when we allow it to do that, and we feel its not only its urgency of attention, but also its importance in those moments. Do we not? Which is what meditation is supposed to do, by the way. It's supposed to bring that organ forth in a more and more predominant way in our life, so that we live with a sense of appreciation and joy that the science of our mind's way won't allow, and thereby begin to give more and more energy over to it, not as a secondary organ, but as a primary one. Because the heart, although we can certainly touch the components of the heart by using words like compassion and love and caring and patience and qualities like that, really what we're talking about in the heart is awareness itself, awareness itself. And the mind is the conceptual way that we form the world around that awareness. Right? It's the particulars within the awareness, the things, the objects, that if we ever stopped long enough, we would see that those things too were composed of awareness, but we don't really stop that long. And as long as we stay in movement, we can fool ourselves by thinking that those objects have a substance in and of themselves. And therefore, awareness is something we're accessing outside of that conceptualization, when really the conceptualization is part of the same frame, part of the same medium that the awareness is itself. So the awareness, if we understand it as such, is intrinsic to our being, right? And meditation points to that inherent quality in us, that if we stop long enough, if we relax, if we're just quiet with ourselves, there's a blessing, there's a grace of awareness that's present within and around us. And a beautiful presence of being that we all have, in which the heart is so obviously present because the sensitivity is present within our observation, within our perceptions. And yet, most of us find ourselves believing more in the emotional realms of what our minds offer than in that sense of presence. Or in the thinking that we have, the conceptualization of life, rather than to what's inherently there when we're quiet. I think that's interesting, isn't it? We believe more in the artificial, the induced world that of our making, of our concepts, of our thoughts, than we do of the natural one that is there when we are quiet and the existence, the part of our being, is felt. And because very quickly we pick up that conceptualization and move with it and let the presence fall away. And the presence gets, of course, confiscated by the attention we give the conceptualization, by the way we give the words, the things of our life, the appearances of things. And when we do that, the secular comes forward and the spiritual goes to the background. Because, I like to just go back to this from time to time, because I think it's not making an enemy out of the mind. We're not trying to now bring the heart forward in its prominence and then to scoff at the mind. And no, the mind was evolved with the exact perceptions that it is meant to have, and that is the sense of self and other. It evolved over the eons so that it would be an organ of self-protection, so that it would provide and give you food on your plate, and work out the details of how you are going to allow yourself to live in safety, protected from the elements, clothed and warm, and etc. And so it's the organ that provides the ability to discern and work our way through life with that particular purpose and intention. And then what happens is that a story grows around all of that activity and all of that sense of separation of me here and the world out there. And that story has a personal history associated with it. And then with that arises emotions around the beliefs of that story. And when emotions arise and thoughts come up, then that story is again validated and given credit. And we are off running in accordance with the mind's description and perception of the world. Meanwhile, the organ that has never moved has never changed one bit, holds all change, but is not dependent upon any qualities whatsoever, and has been outside of the whole process of evolution since day one, is awareness. And we have lost ourselves in such, with the intentionality of the individual me and all of the needs for security and protection, that we have missed what has never changed, what hasn't budged, what's impossible, it cannot change because it holds change. And spirituality is the movement, is the divesting of the energy from what has evolved, the evolutionary, the upper chamber of the hourglass in the poem I read, to that which does not change and cannot change. And so what happens is, and the reason that this works at all, is that the mind, the sense of me, starts, because I'm the mind, the organ, by its nature, must look out and find what it needs in life to procure food or clothing or shelter, medicines, whatever, the requisites of life. And it's constantly looking in terms of its own safety. It feels inside, the sense of me feels, from looking out and seeing the world in that way, it feels diminished. It feels limited. And that hurts. So living in the mind, its perception, embedded within the mind perception, is hurt, is pain, is suffering. And the sense of self-limitation. And we're constantly trying to get over that limitation by us getting whatever the mind thinks it needs in order to feel fulfilled, which has long since moved beyond the dinner table to the products of the world, because now it's proliferated out and the story has grown to such magnitude, it's no longer about just staying healthy and, you know, adequately fed. It's about self-betterment and self-comparison and all that. See, because the story just has grown over the millennium. And yet, and so what we have at stake grows, because as you add more and more things that you have to have, and more sense of validation that we get through that perception, the more investment we give to that organ, the mind. Meanwhile, something does not move. And the mind formulates, because the more powerful it becomes, the less it is inclined towards the heart's way, which seems vague and sloppy. So we'll have a Valentine's Day, but let's get over it and on with our business. And so it, but it tries to invest in things that it thinks are fair, not loving, but fair. Fairness now begins to hold the propriety, because I want to live in a fair world. It makes it less, it makes it easier to live in a fair world. So I want to, and I can't access love in the same way, because I've caved myself into the mind to such a degree that love is very tangential and very possessive, if I have it at all, and also related to a feeling. And so if I don't have that feeling, I feel like I don't have love. And when I do have that feeling, then I have love. But it comes so rarely that mostly I feel drained of love. It's not available to me. That I put in my own systems, called mental systems of the heart. There are things that I feel like, you know, when I hear words like compassion and love and patience and things like that, I think, well, yeah, we should have those things. So we'll bring them forward, but we'll do it through the mind, not through the purity of the heart. And So we'll establish laws so that people will operate in accordance with the perception of other people's, in not interfering with other people's rights, which is very different than seeing from oneness. And having that inherent sense of not betraying that. I mean, if you see from oneness, you don't betray oneness. But because the mind sees two-ness, T-W-O-ness, then it has to put together laws that are similar to laws of oneness, because those are the laws that are both are best suited for getting along with each other. Don't steal, don't kill, right? All of that. And structure, red lights and green lights. And there we are. And the mind has been translating the issues of the heart since time immemorial. The heart says, rest in the completion you are. The mind says, I have to find it first. And then uses its concepts to discover it itself. Meanwhile, the heart has not budged. Has not moved. Still contains the original beginning. But the mind, because it has given itself over in commitment and invested so much through the millennium in the story of its own species and the story of the personal story within that species, takes on spirituality as another way it's going to make one from two. Because it can only see from duality, it only sees me and you, but somehow it's going to work that perception back to oneness. And it's going to think its way through that. And so it sets out to do that. And we sit down and we try to figure out the right mechanism for meditation, the mechanics of it, because the mind is a mechanical machine. It tries to solve things according to the science of it, but not according to the inherent beauty of something. Not according to the inherent sensitivity of the heart. And so the mind takes on a subject like completion, and it says, okay, I'm not complete. I can feel it in myself. I don't feel complete, so I need to find a way to possess whatever I need to in order to feel complete. And so it takes the messages of the heart, which is always complete, and it acts from a feeling. And this is an important point, because if we looked at our lives, we would see that most of our actions are governed by a feeling. And we give such validity to a feeling. A feeling of incompleteness holds a whole story about ourselves as being incomplete, when really it's only a feeling. It's only an emotion. Because we've invested so much in the continuation of the story, we take the feeling and run with it rather than asking just a basic question about it. Is it possible that I could be complete even feeling incomplete? Is it possible that completion is not to be gained in procuring something outside of myself and bringing it into my life, but rather resting without resistance in the feeling of being incomplete. If we were willing to test that single theory, your life would turn dramatically on itself. If you were intent, sincere, to do that. But we've invested so much. You see, it keeps coming down to how much we have at stake in running with the mind. Our whole lives are at stake. Everything that we've held meaningful to ourselves has been invested along the way through the mind's door. And so the mind continues to be the monarch of the journey, to hold the disciplined place for strategies and for perception, the truth of perceptions. And the more we do that, the more we see that the mind puts us in a vice between what we are and what we need to be. And we're constantly being forced to act upon what we need to be, because what we are feels as if, again, it feels as if it's diminished in some way. And if we're not advancing on that, then the feeling seems to indicate that we'll just be slipping backward. And so we have to stay productively useful in order to keep that feeling a little bit at bay so that we can continue to hold the story, invest in the story, and to feel like the story has a firm and a final resolution to it. And to the bypasser, it looks sincere and right. And so awakening is finding or protecting or discovering the right methodology. Not changing the perception. We invest in the perception because that's part of the story of you and me and what I need to do to become whatever I need is my future hopes and expectations. So I don't question the perception of whether that's true, which is the only way the heart can truly be accessed. I continue to hold the perception and try to find the heart that seems not to be in me, but must be out there somewhere. And if I just get the right mechanism, the right mechanics, the right way to say metta, the right teacher to tell me a different strategy for meditation, a new technique, never mind the perception maintains itself, I'll be able to resolve this whole thing. So awakening, from that point of view, is awakening is meant to happen to someone. It's going to happen to me. But awakening doesn't happen to me and will not happen to me and cannot happen to me. And awakening is awakening out of the perception of duality. And that's what it means to awaken. But as long as we're so fixed within that perception and encouraging our spiritual practice from that perception, then the mind holds a locked door on awakening. Now, it's not that we are without access to the heart. The heart continues to be there because it's never moved. It's like the eternal grandmother who's just waiting for the return of the prodigal son or daughter. But it just can't get through the noise, the distortion of the perception of two. How can one get through the perception of two? And so It comes, it starts rising up forever. It's continually rising up. But the noise of the mind, the noise of tunis, keeps it blockaded and packed and compact and suppressed. And we begin to see that words, because all words carry the sense of me and you and this and that, block the avenue of the heart. And it makes it feel like I'm outside looking in to life. And it also makes me feel like if there is a sense of wholeness here, that something radically has to change with me in order to make that wholeness happen. And I take that as being needing more improvement, needing to work with the paramis, needing to be more generous, to be more kind, because the mind only looks in terms of quantifiable terms. It says, I have this much, I feel it in me, I don't have as much as I feel I could have, and therefore I need to have more. It forever works on the journey of getting over itself to solve the problem. So we look for the heart through the concepts, through the noise continues to distort the heart's message, like light going through water. As soon as light touches water, it refracts at a different angle. As soon as the heart touches the noise of the mind, it refracts. So the language of the vision needs to be seen through, if we're serious. Is it true? We can start with the most apparent divisions, emotional divisions like anger and fear and loneliness and all the things, ways that we feel cut off, and not move. Let's just not move from those things and see if they hold up to the story that we have given them, to their accreditation. See if they hold up, if anger will just, if I don't act it out, something awful, you know, I'll just burst inside, or whatever mind thinks. Well, let's just see. Let's just do an experiment. And sometimes having that absolute raw willingness, I can remember in my own practice, I was very young in it, and I loved chocolate, which I still do. It hasn't gone away, but I have a little more control. But back then I had no control, and so I took a piece of chocolate and I put it on my dashboard of my car, and I was going to go through the day and just have it right there, but not going to eat it. Right? But I was not going to do it. I mean, I was like white knuckling the steering wheels as I wasn't paying attention too much to where I was going, but a lot to that chocolate. Right? But there was something there in that determination to see this, to pit myself, so to speak, which is the only thing we can do at an early stage, is pit yourself against your desires. By God, you know, let's just see this thing. Just see if this is going to kill me not to eat chocolate. To see if it's going to kill us not to respond to our loneliness. And as soon as we're willing not to move, guess what our partner is in non-movement? That which has always been still. The heart. As soon as we're willing to meet the world of movement, which is the world of the mind, the world of division, the world of this and that, with a non-moving determination, guess what organ partners with us in that? So we ask ourselves, what does the heart look like? Well, it's not struggling. Why? Because what's there to struggle when it has everything? when it's one. It's stillness, because why would it move? It's not trying to move anywhere, because it has everything. It's one. It's ethically integritous, because it has no reason to betray that, because it's one. There's no self and other dichotomy, because it's one. Look at the logic of it from the mind, and you'll see this beautiful symmetry, like a beautiful opening flower. And it's possessionless. It feels the need for nothing. And so the heart pulls us into that stillness. If we just allow ourselves to rest for a moment against the rapid movement of the mind. You see, the mind doesn't stop. The organ continues. It continues because it's had 3.8 billion years of momentum. And so it's not going to stop. If you're thinking that you're going to have some breakout, rather, we stop. And then it stops. But as long as the rat runs, the wheel moves. The rat stops running and the wheel stops. We're expecting the wheel to stop so we can get off. It doesn't stop. Because we have an expectation of it stopping is one reason it doesn't stop. So the language of the mind, the impersonating language of the mind, you see. The mind says, I must possess this thing. I must possess it. I must possess patience. I must possess kindness. I must possess love. I must possess, and we hear these wonderful qualities, compassion. I must possess that. I must have that. And if we'd ever stop, if we just were just be quiet for a moment, there wouldn't be anything missing. As long as we weren't expecting a feeling tone associated with what it is that we thought we were going to get from being still. If we think suddenly we'll feel loving, that's basing love on a feeling tone. And love is much more. Sometimes there is a feeling tone associated with it, but mostly there is just union associated with it. Depending upon what it interacts with, there will be different feeling tones. But to base the sense of love totally on a feeling tone is to miss it entirely. And our practice isn't working because there's not enough love, because I don't feel it. I must own it. So, see, listen, what we're trying to do is learn, it's like we're in a language course. So when I have to possess it, when I have to own it, when I need it, that's the language of the mind. So we have to be smart enough. No, I'm not going to buy into that. I'm not going to buy into that. If it's not here, it's not worth pursuing. Let's just have that agreement. If we have that agreement together, we will find our ways very quickly into this. But if we betray that, then we're, because you'll find 10,000 voices telling you a different, something different. That you need to cultivate this and encourage that and resist this. And we love that because it gives us more to do, which promotes the sense of me, and says, well, how am I doing? Am I getting there? So let's just have an agreement that if it's not here, it's not worth pursuing. And we can listen to every teacher who comes through, and we listen from that perspective. Anybody that takes us out of ourselves, it's not worth it. It's either here or it's not worth it. And then we have to be willing to see that it's here. So we have to be willing to quiet sufficiently to find what has never moved. Because all quieting means is that we're stepping out of the pursuit and the momentum of the mind that tries to secure everything, right? Remember that this organ's intended evolutionary purpose was to make the organism safe. So when we step out of the mind, we have to step out of that perception of life, that I need, that I'm constantly in need, which is a huge, momentous challenge to us. And the second thing is that I'm not going to wait for a feeling tone to convince me that this love is here. I'm not going to rely on feeling tones to justify my experience. But there is something that justifies one experience, and it can be sensed through the body, and that's presence, that's awareness. And I'm not going to let the mind say, oh, I'm really getting somewhere. This is not going to be a journey after something. It's just not. Because, see, the mind only perceives what it can see, what it can verify, what it can quantify, what it can actually locate. And what we have to do is to suspend our disbelief and the unknown, and the unverifiable. So we hear the Dharma and we go, God, I want that. I want it. I want that. And already we're off base. The most innocent, we sit there and listen, and oh, I want that. And already we're as far from the Dharma as we could ever be. And I'm not going to make the heart a task. I'm just not going to make the heart a task. I'm not going to set myself into accomplishing, being accomplished in the quality of the heart. I am going to find the heart. The inclination of the mind, the intention of the mind is to find it now. The intention is there. But it's not going to be fooled anymore by the mind's language, by looking and thinking that it's somewhere else but now. And therefore, when I feel that enormous pull towards kindness, towards contentment, towards the resolution of all struggle, towards non-resistance, I get very quiet and let that pull of the heart pull me down, not up and out like a fire hose, but down into the very center of my being, down into stillness. And I'm not going to make the heart a project. And I'm not going to judge its proximity. How kind am I now? Gosh, I was kinder last week. I've got more kindness to do. And love, my God, I've got so much to do in love. I just barely feel. I'm not going to get into that. That's the language of the mind. I'm not going to do that to my practice. In fact, the more I see that words invalidate love, and the more intention I have towards love, the more I am pulled away from words towards quiet. not because I want to be quiet, but because I see they disturb the love that's there. And I won't be fooled anymore. And I'm going to use this thing in the right direction, with the right, with a wise, in the wise direction, with wise effort, with wise discernment, so that I begin to understand, okay, oh, that's the mind. I'm feeling so unlovable. I'm so poor. I'm such an inadequate. Because once we get the story going, we have 3.8 billion years of it. We have a species record of it. It's not just our little genetic thing. It's the whole momentum of our species. The whole momentum of life, really. Once we lose ourselves in that, it's like being lost in some kind of maze. It's just impossible to find our way out. And we're very lucky that we, any of us, have heard the Dharma. Because it is so hard just to hear beyond that momentous pull. And I'm going to look for the forgeries of how the mind has distorted natural qualities of the heart. And let's just go through some of these forgeries. I call them mental forgeries of the mind. We talked about one, caring changes caring, love changes to fairness. And remorse and worry. See how much I care, but you can see how much I care by how badly I feel. You know that one? And the worse I feel, the more it shows I care. No, that's mental, that's no good. I can see it. I'm not going to buy into that one. Compassion changes to pity. Where I'm here and I'm looking in my safe little enclosed sense of me, and I'm, how terrible the homeless, you know, how awful the homeless. We should do something about them. That's the mind's interpretation of compassion. Compassion is an alive interaction, not a separative judgment. And this is one that I've been beating the drum on lately, and that's equanimity to indifference. I'm so tired of feeling that I just as soon go into a non-feeling state where I'm not being provoked by life any longer. And love as a feeling tone. I'm not going to be fooled. I'm not going to look for the validation of love as a feeling. But rather as a sense of closeness, of being immersed within, is the best way I can say it, but it's not well said. Of abiding within is better said. That's love. And I'm not going to be fooled by the mind's shadow need for feeling, to verify, to validate itself. Because I realize that the mind only validates itself from quantifiable things like a feeling. And patience. The first one is the heart word. The second one is what the mind does to the heart word. Patience into waiting. Now there's time. When I'm waiting, there's time. Patience has no time. Patience isn't an anxiety relationship with time. It's just presence. And somebody who's present and not impatient, you'll say, wow, how patient you are. But they won't be feeling patience at all. They just won't have moved because awareness doesn't move. Here's one, sincerity to seriousness. I want to get serious about this. I'll force sincerity through my seriousness. I'll be serious. Get serious now. I want to get really serious about my practice. Sincerity is a natural pulling, a natural passion, a natural interest. And if we want the antidote to seriousness, it's appreciation. Because you can get serious but never appreciate what's in front of you. But once you start appreciating what's in front of you, then you'll be sincere about it. So we're playing with these words, we're playing with the language. I just want to get you a sense of the inflection of the language and how we know what organ is operating. That's all. Here's one. Tolerance for political correctness. Or the denial of prejudice. I'm not prejudiced. The heart, when it feels prejudice, it leaps towards it. Because it knows it's not true. And if there's any residual opinion that makes prejudice seem true, it moves right in there, and it's not afraid to admit it, and it looks at it, and it doesn't try to politically correct everything, which is using words for tolerance. And we're not going to find tolerance within words. And so you can't ever relax and just say what is naturally there. You have to frame it in such a way that you feel so contrived that you say nothing. And all of us liberals hold people to their speech rather than to the quality of their heart. Somebody who really wants to explore their prejudice, the quality of that sincerity, isn't given time to do that, isn't given the space of dialogue and communication and throwing the ideas. They have to hold themselves as if they had no prejudice, or they will be judged considerably in this culture, and this culture in particular. And the sense of completion through the mind store becomes a sense of possessiveness. It wants to possess completion. So anytime there's a sense of possessing anything, we know we're not complete in the very fact of what the actions that are being taken in relationship to that. And I'm just playing with it. We can go endlessly on these things, but we're moving on. Completion, possession, devotion. Devotion isn't an act of attrition, it's an act of humility. It's an act of wonder, really. It's being wondrous, in which everything you want to bow to everything. That's devotion. Because everything is seen as sacred. And the mind makes that a commitment. Instead of devotion, it's, I'll be committed. I'll stay here. I don't want to stay here, but I'll stay here. But I'm not staying here for the right reasons, which is because I want to understand, because I want to open this thing up. I'm staying here because I said I was going to stay here, and I'm good. I'm a man of my word. See how the mind, it looks good, doesn't it? Looks good. Just doesn't do anything. So we have to reframe this whole thing. We have to know the language of the heart, and we know the language of the mind. We know when the mind is impersonating the heart. We know what the heart is, and we are not going to leave that directionality. We're not going to give up the wise view of that. We're not going to be fooled anymore. Because we become very discerning of how the mind keeps attempting, through its conditioning, to pull us out of the heart. It thinks it, in fact, it denigrates the heart. It calls it vague. It's sloppy. And what the heart does in response to the mind is just surrender resistance. It doesn't struggle with the mind. It just surrenders resistance. Because the mind can only sustain itself in the resistance it needs to hold the world outside of itself as an object. That creates, there's an enormous amount of tension to keep the world skewed in that way. And as soon as there is the willingness to surrender the resistance, the edginess, the struggle of it all, the world comes back and implodes back into its rightful shape of union. And so the heart doesn't argue. It just won't ever resist what the mind's doing. It lets the mind do whatever it's doing, just doesn't resist it. Anger, no resistance. Fear, no resistance. Impatience, no resistance. It keeps meeting the very struggle with the sense of it being still. And therefore has to win out. Paper always wraps rock. Surrender. You don't surrender to God, you surrender your argument to God. And we just keep coming back in. And it becomes the simplest thing. The simplest thing. The burden is off. It's the simplest thing. May we all know the simplest things. Thank you all. Can we sit for a minute or two? So I saved this particular talk to last because I think once have defined that the way of this practice is the way of the heart, then we have to know what the heart is and what the mind's impersonation is.
Trying to understand this a little better. I find myself in my head evaluating and judging a lot. And so I have been working on trying to bring my awareness in the moment when I'm evaluating something or judging. And as I'm listening to you tonight talking about this, what I think I am really...
So the question, I'm being enormously distracted by people leaving. So I'm sorry, I apologize for that. Please, people, don't do that. Does the heart qualities arise with awareness? Is that the question? They're one in the same thing. Okay, so when awareness, think of it, awareness has a knowing quality to it. It knows judgment. It sees judgment, right? Judgment. It doesn't judge judgment. The mind comes in and judges judgment, but it sees judgment. So the best we can do to access the purity of awareness, the purity of the heart, is to not add anything to what the mind is doing, but to be able to perceive what the mind is doing without adding anything, without adding any movement in relationship to it. So wherever we catch the spiral out effect, that's where we end it. Even if we're judging the judger and then judging the judging and then all of that, then finally wherever we catch it, that's okay. Because at that point, the awareness is without words. And at that point, it's not adding a new judgment to the situation.
Yes.
Okay. So when awareness sees or feels pain in oneself, you will feel often an interest in that. What's going on here? It's like, it's a concern. It's a caring, right? So you can say it a lot of different ways. But it feels like interest. What's going on here? Like you give a damn about yourself. Instead of not caring about yourself, you care about yourself. That's what it feels like. Right? What's going on? Like an alarm clock went off and you went, what? Like that. So don't look for it beyond that. Don't look for it as a feeling tone in any other way, except perhaps just through an interest in yourself. And it will do everything. And just don't add anything to that interest. Don't add a discriminating evaluation or judgment don't add anything. Don't add a blueprint to get out of it. Don't add a mechanism to get out of it. Don't try to get out of it. Don't try to do anything to it. The less you do, the more you allow the heart to flower. It seems paradoxical because the sense of me wants to do something about it. That's the momentum of all those millions and billions of years. The wanting to do, the wanting to get over, the wanting to get this thing fixed, that's the momentum. The willingness not to do that is the quality of discriminating wisdom that knows that if it does do anything, it's just going to get back into the embroiled in the whole story once more.
So are you saying then that if I don't try to be compassionate, compassion will arise?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. That's exactly. The clearest way to get to compassion is not to try to be compassionate. In fact, eliminate all your efforts towards the heart. Except the one that says, okay, let me see, is this, what's speaking here? And what am I believing here? Except the discriminating wisdom to look. Compassion, you don't need an exercise for your heart to reach out to pain. There's nothing it needs. Even the most hardened criminal, if he or she would let herself or himself do it, feel that, if they would allow themselves to be that open, but they're so barricaded that they wouldn't, but it doesn't mean that their heart isn't just as pure as everyone else's. It's just covered with so much scar tissue that it's almost impossible for it to ever to access. But we're on the road to doing just that, so it's not so hard for ours. And so when we catch ourselves going the wrong way, we want to just be quiet and look at this thing. Like when you're reading the paper and you see somebody has died or somebody has had a tragic ending, instead of just moving on to the next story, which is the mind's way, let's get over this, get to something I can feel it for a moment. Let the pain in. Okay, all.